Welcome to the Center for Internet Security's podcast, Cybersecurity Where You Are. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we are at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or even running a state or local government. Join CIS's Sean Atkinson and Tony Sager as they discuss trends and threats, ways to implement controls and infrastructure, explore best practices, and interview experts in the industry. We are here to bring clarity to these complex issues to bring confidence in the connected world.
Hello and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by the host with the most, the Hall of Famer, Mr. Tony Sager. Tony, how are you, sir?
Great, Sean. Great to be back with you.
Wonderful. And we have a very, very special guest, dear friend, Tara Wheeler. Tara, how are you?
I am absolutely fabulous. I am stocked with tea and malapropisms for today's conversation. So it's going to be a fun one. Thank you so much for inviting me. Tony, Sean, it was so great to see you folks, especially at last con. I got a chance to shake your hands in person. The work that you do for this community is absolutely wonderful. It's a joy to be here with you today. Let us crack some jokes.
Wonderful.
Count us in. That's awesome.
Yeah. So Tara, how about you give us a little bit of your background and the work that you're currently doing with MSSP?
Absolutely. I would love to talk about that. So I'm a person who's, I'm a failed academic is a pretty good way to put it. When you're a failed academic with a bunch of computer skills and you find yourself, late at night in that lab 15, 20 years ago, and it turns out you might have some skills that would work better on the outside, you can talk your way into web application security. So I ended up doing some fun stuff in information security, web app security, and then started doing, I think, more and more in the realm of trying to communicate what I had seen in getting not only the kind of people into information technology that would help to make our field better, but also started to really see kind of the problems underlying some of the current infrastructure of the internet, some of the security problems that needed to get tackled. My curse is that I'm good at crafting analogies. So if you want something to explain, NIST using home break-ins or blockchain using an omelet, I'm your girl. And it turns out that's a really useful skill. So a lot of what I do every day, no matter what I'm doing, is craft messages that help people understand their world. And I do that not only as a senior fellow for global cyber policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, do a little sliver of that, where I tell policymakers what they're doing wrong. On my everyday calendar, I'm the CEO of Red Queen Dynamics, which is what I get to do when I get to tell small businesses what they're doing right about cybersecurity and compliance. And that's really joy-filled. And just as you and I were all talking, I've spent my time in corporate information security. I used to be the queen of the house of no, and now, you were in trouble if you had to get on a Zoom call with me. And now people smile when they get on and off Zoom calls with me. So it's a pretty good feeling. I love what I do.
That's awesome. That is so cool. So now, given that background, and given everything that you've seen over, obviously your career, what has motivated you now to focus on this element of continuous cybersecurity compliance and focus then on the spaces of those that, we'll call the cyber underserved, those that need the most help? What motivated you to move in that direction?
A little bit of anger, maybe a lot of anger. No, I'm enraged. Straight up, I'm enraged. And I'm enraged when people feel powerless, when their power is being taken away from them. And that tends to be reflected in the kinds of things I care about, advocate for, and talk about. So right now, there's a huge gap in what renowned information security researcher Wendy Nather calls the security poverty line. I'm sure you've encountered this concept before. There's a lot of people in this country who are the have-nots in information security, and they're the have-nots for a couple of reasons. First, nobody has explained to them how information security impacts their lives. Second, they couldn't afford your brain, my brain, any of the brains that are operating in information security if they tried. I'm a very expensive human. So are you. So are all of us. And no small business can afford to engage an information security firm that can actually help them address some of the problems that an enterprise tech company would face every single day and would think nothing of dropping $150,000 on an incident response for, right? So the thing that makes me angry is that right now I'm watching adversaries of these small businesses grow in capacity and ability to attack, especially American businesses. I'm seeing it every single day. And the ROI, the return on investment for attacking small businesses is improving over time with the addition of AI tools. There's a lot of people that think that that artificial intelligence is going to revolutionize information security. I think the most major impact AI is going to have on information security, it already did, which is the ability to make a phishing email sound like it's coming from idiomatic English speakers. That is the single biggest change, sea change, when it comes to attacking small businesses. Now, here's the problem. Small businesses don't care about security, and they're kind of not going to buy security. They're going to do what their MSP or MSSP tells them to do. Now, that's a managed service provider or a managed security service provider, and their job is to be the IT guys, honestly. And I grew up as an IT guy. The first time I dropped out of high school, Sean, I went to work for my stepdad's computer repair company. He was a break fix MSP. He still is. He's celebrating his 30th anniversary this year, and I'm so proud of him. And it was a wonderful experience. I did get earfuls about dropping out of school an awful lot, but I did get a chance to put a lot of machines together. So I grew up in this world, and I see the impact that having a trusted security and computer advisor has for small businesses and people that don't do this every day. If you are a law firm, if you're a trucking company, you know, you don't maintain that expertise in-house. You hire a company to help you, just like you hire a lawyer or an HR specialist or any of the other, you know, expertises that we need when we run small businesses. I run a small business technically right now, and I don't have an in-house counsel or accountant. I would very much like them to be safe and secure, and yet it turns out they are the most prime targets for a lot of the kinds of adversaries that are targeting them. Last year, ransomware attacks, on average, up until last year, ransomware attacks, on average, were about $500 in requested ransom. And the problem there, of course, is that what small business owner can figure out how to buy $500 worth of Bitcoin, much less transfer it. But you know what happened last year? The price went up to $1,000 last year. Guess why? It's inflation.
Inflation.
It's a business to run small business ransom attacks, and it's adjusted for inflation with proper customer service. That is awe-inspiring in the wrong way. And it enrages me that small business in this country doesn't have an advocate in the way that I think they should. And so I think I've kind of stepped into that with a little bit of anger, maybe. And also the fact that people, again, smile when I get on calls with them now, because I can tell them what they can do to stay safe. And that's a good feeling.
Tara, we feel your both emotion and pain. And, you know, for me, the trigger was I live in a rural county where my doctor is a one-man practice and the dentist is two chairs, no waiting. And, you know, my lawyer is a one-man thing. And yeah, we've somehow in this industry, we've created a security model that most of our economy can't actually execute. And it may make security wizards feel better, but it's terrible public policy, right? When we look at this, right? Why is everyone trying to defend themselves? And it just seems really out of whack to the problem. So I think tried to align ourselves in similar ways to you to think about this at the service provider level. We need scale. We need to go where there's actually a human being who's going to manage the IT and not the, you know, sort of passive victimhood that we've foisted upon the market there. So, but you took a particular slant with your business model, right, around compliance. And explain that, you know, sort of what philosophically what you're trying to do there.
Absolutely. So one of the things I do, and I already told you, I spend a lot of time crafting analogies, is translate the kinds of complicated elements that exist in a compliance framework for people to actually understand what's happening. And what I started to realize, this whole thing started, honestly, in late 2021. I had just come back from the United Kingdom from a four-month stint. I was doing a Fulbright in cybersecurity there, and I was working on the mental health impacts for WannaCry defenders in the National Health Service in the United Kingdom. And I had just talked to some of the people who'd been through hell on earth when it came to the choices they needed to make with technology. Most of us on an everyday basis, we're not yanking laptops out of doctors' hands and saying, if I don't do this now, more people will die. The mental health impacts of ransomware attacks and attacks on people who don't deserve it, hospitals, small businesses, the kinds of people that are just trying to run their lives and make ours better. I came back from that and I was sitting there trying really hard not to write a book. I didn't want to. I had a Microsoft Word document open, and my friend texted me out of the middle of nowhere, and she said, I have got to get through this giant FANG vendor assessment process, and I have no idea how to do it. And I said, okay, send it over. And she sent it over to me, and it was 400 questions on 51 pages asking this woman who runs a recruiting company, a 10, 15 person recruiting company in Seattle. She was going to be, a vendor provider for one of the FANG companies. And she sent this thing over to me, and she said, and I said, okay, what do you need help with? And she said, well, let's start with question one. And I went, oh God. and I said, okay, this sounds like you need some real help and an engagement. She said, sure. And I said, and I kind of like licked a finger, stuck it up in the air. And I said, $4,500 and we'll do it in a week. And she said, okay. And I went, all right. And so I helped her with that. And I wrote her process and policies and grabbed a contractor to give me a hand with it. And she said, all right, that was great. It worked. I've got three friends I need to introduce you to. And I went, all right. Every single time I talked to one of these folks, I raised my price $1,000. By the time I hit $9,500 and I had five more referrals, I went, something's wrong. Something's happening here. And I started seeing something that was going on. It was an inability of small businesses to connect with the massively outsized compliance requirements that they were being required to attest to. And they had no idea what was happening in them. I mean, none. I was able to explain it, but I also, at time number six of doing this, was using the same analogies, the same explanations, going back to the same frameworks. I had a spreadsheet with crosswalked controls in it where I was explaining what they needed to do. And I went, this is dumb. This is not a service. This is a product that needs to exist, that needs to be interlocuted by accountants, lawyers, IT people. This is something that needs to exist out there in the world. So when I started Red Queen Dynamics, what I did was I said, there needs to be a QuickBooks of cyber compliance for small businesses. It needs to be something that sucks in as much information as possible and is understandable, and you have a responsibility to keep it up. But nobody calls into it for help with their taxes every year. You call your accountant, right? And that's because there's the last 5% of it that you can't do on your own. You don't have the expertise. You are an edge case. You know, you got a couple of expenses you don't really understand. And yet, this is keeping track of everything for you. And I realized this was more like what small businesses needed, not the ones that were existential. If you got three guys in a van, you know, they're not worried about compliance. They're on Craigslist trying to, you know, hustle some business on the weekends. I got nothing but respect for that. I started as a cocktail waitress. Ask me how I learned everything I need to know about information security, Tony. I looked at this, and over the course of the last couple of years, you know, the reason and way that we have built this is not only because I realized small businesses would never do this until they had to, but that the service providers who work with them would understand how much energy and effort they spend having the same call every single day with 150 different clients, the level of energy they've got to put into doing one-off compliance checklists, vendor assessment checklists, cyber insurance application processes, and all these things are asking the same damn questions about asset inventory, about password management, about physical security controls, about personal devices. All these things crosswalk, and many of them, frankly, are based on the CIS. Right? They're based on the CIS controls. So I stopped and I looked at that and I was like,
But they have the value added.
You've got a place you want to start.
Slicing, dicing, changing the happies to glads and the reds to blues or whatever. But it is absolutely crazy. And you know, you're exactly right on that, Tara. I think that, you know, somehow we've convinced again the marketplace, right, the society at large, that everybody's a special snowflake. So I have to have like a unique framework for this or a different set of questions for that. But, you know, we used to study this back when I was at NSA and later at CIS, like, wait a minute, these things are 80% the same. The recommendations, the content, why are we spending, you know, 150% of our natural resources to get 80% the same answer? It makes no sense at all. So yeah, that observation, right? And that, you know, going to the provider where there's scale, where there's repeatability, where there's opportunities to look for efficiency, as opposed to asking every small business owner in the country to deal with this, is just, you know, this is common sense is fairly uncommon in the industry, but I think you're onto something here. And I think that makes a lot of sense from, you know, from our perspective and can aligns with us.
Well, what I've discovered as we've done this, I don't know how many folks listening right now deal with any banking or financial information, but it's going to be anybody that is a mortgage broker, payday lender, used car seller, construction company that processes, you know, loans to remodel your kitchen. Any company in the United States that is a non-banking financial institution is governed by the FTC safeguards rule now. Now, this was, they told everybody October 27th of last year, May 27th of this year, it came into effect. If you are an institution that processes financial information, even though you're not a bank, and you experience the loss of more than 500 customers' data, you have 30 days to report it to the FTC. There is no limitation on firm size. And that means that a four-person used car lot in Auburn, Washington, a little bit south of me, is subject to the exact same rules and regulations that Google or Amazon or, you know, LendingTree.com is subject to. And they don't know it, but they are subject to it. And ignorance of the law is no defense. So one of the things that we did was we took the FTC safeguards rules, the nine rules that are specifically applicable to these institutions and organizations, and we crosswalked them with CIS, with NIST. We'd already done it. Our customers had already filled out most of the information relevant to the FTC safeguards rule. So once we added the additional three or four questions that we wanted to really carefully specify for that, and we started asking people in our diagnostics, hey, are you a financial institution? Do you process people's money information too? We just turned that live. And all of the customers that we had that deal with financial information, construction companies, trucking companies that process auto loans, stuff like that, they woke up, then, you know, had a cup of coffee and found they were 85% compliant with no work that they had to redo for this because we'd already crosswalked it. We'd already asked them all of these questions. They had already appeared in CIS 8. In NIST SMB 7621, as you know, the SMB guide, they already appear in the Kickstart guide from Sightline Security. They already appeared in the GCA Small Business Toolkit, which we actually rolled out about 4 months ago. So thanks to the folks at Global Cyber Alliance on that one. But yeah, anybody who's already answered those questions, why would you redo that work? Why would you do that? And yet people are caught totally flat-footed that this is a responsibility of theirs. So yeah, this is something that has really been meaningful to us because you're a small business owner. You don't have time to redo this again and again. And small business owners are facing more and more requests for this kind of checklist for cyber insurance. They're starting to be able to not get cyber insurance because they can't do continuous attestation. And continuous attestation is the act of repetitively ensuring inside the organization that you have actual controls on the stuff that you say you have controls over when you've applied for cyber insurance. And most cyber insurance policyholders have held their nose, closed their eyes, checked green all the way down, paid $4,000 in hope because they have to do that in order to get into enterprise supply chains.
Exactly. So this is great. So when we're thinking of this though, and Tony, I'm going to throw it in. I always owe you money. But one of the things here I see as a challenge is that the requirements are not getting any simpler. In fact, they're multiplying, right? We get to the fog of more, and this is what I owe Tony for. So it's this continuous element where it's, I'll say from a policymaker perspective or from, let's say, larger businesses or industries, keep adding, you know, there's these additive elements of requirements for compliance. But I'd say I'd abstract that, Tara, because I think it's moving you away from security where you're trying to check the boxes, as it were, over time, but not necessarily focusing on the threats to a respective organization. And ultimately, yes, there's going to be crossover, right? It's not just, oh, I've done compliance, but it didn't mean anything to risk mitigation or a control capability. But I think it's taking us in different directions. And in your case and what you've mentioned, people just don't know as to, well, I did all the checkbox pieces. I'm secure, right? I'm done. I don't need to worry about anything else. And I think that there's lost in translation in a lot of cases is, well, no, it's to your point, there's a continual element, but there's also security considerations of the parenthetic in which you exist is you've got existential threats that don't necessarily follow a checkbox approach. Any thoughts in that space?
Oh, so many thoughts. Not only thoughts, but opinions and maybe even some hot takes.
Yeah.
And I would be thrilled to provide them for you. Okay, so here's what's going on. The difference, I think, between the way that we tackle this, and I'm so proud to work with the team that I work with. They're just brilliant. Our head of product, Tilda Lohengrim, has been head of product security and product development for Mozilla, Brave, Tall Poppy, the Committee to Protect Journalists. I mean, if there is a product out there that's intended to translate security requirements for people who are in danger, they have had a hand in building it, or they are the person that was looked to as the inspiration for building it. I'm awed by their approach to it. Our head of infrastructure spent 3 years at SolarWinds. He was like, "Don't ignore that on my resume." When he asked me about our coming aboard, and I was like, "Are you kidding me? Get over here! I want to know everything you see." You know, the folks that are on this team, they approach it in this magical way, where instead of having a checkbox that is being held onto by the MSP, where they call and they spend hours, days, you know, for a one-off experience of asking people inside this small business about the answers to technical controls. What we do is we ask the people inside that small business a simple question every so often, maybe once every week, once every 2 or 3 weeks. They get an email, they hit a button, they answer a question, and the answer to the question about that's going to feed up into compliance, but is just translated for a regular person, is not a question about password management or asset inventory. It's, is your home and work email password different? And that question is a shocker, an eye-opening, just mind-blowing experience for a lot of MSPs, because they're finding that the answer in that case, in a substantial minority of cases, even now, is yes. People use the same password everywhere, and that includes their home and work email. That's the keys to the kingdom right there. So we ask those questions, and we find that asking those questions gets people to real security. A question like, do you ever access your work information on your personal phone? That's not a question that appears on any compliance framework, but it goes directly to whether or not there's MDM. It goes to whether or not asset inventory is being conducted appropriately, because if you've got devices accessing internal systems that are not part of asset inventory, that's what that question gets to. But you don't have to translate that for a 30-person trucking company in Iowa. You just need to ask them that question and let the MSP figure out what the next biggest issue they've got in security is and fix one thing a quarter. That's how you end up getting that information. We discover shadow IT. We discover that people don't understand the questions that they've been asked. We discover that people have checked green on a bunch of boxes, but internally, they're actually not doing any of those things. And then it's an opportunity for their MSP or MSSP to take a look at their own dashboard across all their clients and go, hey, this is heckin' not good. We've got 60% of this company reporting that they have turned two-factor authentication off because it's annoying, right? You got to figure out a different solution for that one. And that, you've got to go to your service provider, your person who can be that translation matrix between what is needed for compliance and what's appropriate. And those relationships belong to the service provider. They belong to the MSPs and MSSPs that care about and have that, you know, 100 client list, that 1,000 client list, who know those people, yep, who can translate and do the right thing for them.
That's wonderful. And one of the things that I compliment you on a lot, obviously, is this continuous element, because it's not a lot of what you see today is in and done, right? Answer these questions, pay me the money, walk away, here's your report. The approach you're taking is you're building really both a resiliency over time with the answers to the respective questions. You're able to create a profile that will work and also be implemented to be effective as a security control, but also aligning to compliance. Was that always the intention?
We absolutely do it intentionally. The continuous part of it was always the intention. I am so proud of what we have built. And normally you want to be really careful. I appreciate so much that you've given me this opportunity to brag about my team and our product. You want to be careful sometimes, you're not coming off as too salesy, but I'm so proud of this continuous attestation, because it goes to the heart of the wasted time and the frustration that small businesses in this country feel when they're being expected to do something that is nebulous, highly technical, enshrined in regulation now, but there's no support for them to do it. So it was absolutely always our intention to trickle these questions out. It takes one person about 18 seconds to answer one of our questions. And it's always going to be a simple question. It's going to be something like, do you ever access work information on your personal device? Do you ever use public Wi-Fi? right? We'll ask a simple question like that one. And the reason we do this continuously is we need to constantly be reporting the process of what's happening inside that business to the MSP so they understand what's happening and they have that picture of what's going on. But inside the small business, they don't need to experience those painful hours-long phone calls. This is something that is so different for them that honestly, they don't believe it. We have people come aboard, and a couple of weeks after they've come aboard, they've done their diagnostic questions. You know, it takes about 2 minutes for any one person to onboard onto what we're doing. It's just a simple web app. And they get a question every so often and they answer that question. We have people that contact us 3 and 4 weeks in. I've had two people in the last 3 weeks contact me a little angry, like, hey, when are we going to get started with this? And I was like,
you're already there.
I don't know how to tell you this, Jeff.
Sarah, this is security. It's supposed to be painful.
It's supposed to be awful. It's supposed to be painful. And I was like, I know. I am very good at making security extremely painful for people who are deliberately screwing up, who are causing problems for the – I fight for the users, right? And so I'm very good at making security miserable for you if you are causing problems for the users. But for small businesses, it is joy-filled to me to tell them you're done. You are done. You do have to do this on an ongoing basis. It's like if you decided on January 2nd that you wanted to eat healthier and run a marathon. And so you ran 700 miles that first week of January and you ate 2.5 tons of broccoli that first week of January. And you're like, well, I'm done for the year.
Right.
Number one, yep. You're not going to do a good job at either of those two things. And number two, that's not what this is, right? You need to have that experience of doing a couple push-ups every other day and trying to swap out your veggies when you can. And that continuous trickle not only makes it easier, but it actually gets you the results over time. That's the actual difference. You have to have faith in that nudge behavior process, because inside small businesses, we're building in just this little tiny minute or two every single week. That's a minute or two over the entire business added up every week. And then over time, what that adds up to is compound interest. And we know what Albert Einstein said about compound interest. He was pretty impressed with it, more impressed with it than relativity, right? So that's what this is it's compound interest on simplicity, on understanding what you need to do. And then, of course, the MSPs and service providers who look at this can point in time, figure out what happened where. And I'm not going to get too deep into the business mechanics of it, but suffice to say that the return on investment for an MSP that doesn't have to spend 6 hours figuring out who has two-factor turned off on their phones with an individual phone call to everybody inside a business, they're pretty thrilled about it too.
Definitely. What becomes, I'll say it this way, habit forming, right? Because the way you ask the question as well, also as they think about that in the future, am I accessing work product on my personal device? That's a question they can conceptualize in their mind as to better security practice. And it's not, it's NIST 800 AC1, and then I'll go through all the parenthetic, right? It's a question that they can relate to. And it's also a teaching opportunity as well. I mean, it's hitting so many different marks. It's crazy. It's amazing.
Well, we also ask a couple questions that are pretty simple about passwords, right? And we also expire questions on best practice timelines. So, you have to ask questions of people about passwords every 90 days. I think we absolutely do not require that people change passwords. In fact, that's only something that the MSP or MSSP can decide, right? But we ask those questions because it's best practice in compliance to ask questions about it every 90 days. But when somebody answers their question, there's a little snippet that follows answering that question. They can always explain if they don't understand what's happening or they think somebody else should answer the question instead of them. But there's a little snippet that follows just to say, if you want to learn any more about this, here's a couple of links that might help. And you know how we teach people how to generate passwords? We send them to the Randall Monroe comic, the XKCD comic, correct horse battery staple.
Yes.
So that they understand how to make an easy password.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be complicated. No. And just doing that gets you to the 99.999 percentile when it comes to password creation, right? So it doesn't have to be painful. It can take 18 seconds a week for a single person to be contributing to instead of a problem for the information security posture of their company.
Amazing. Amazing. And again, doing it in such a fashion with such simplicity, it's almost, I don't know, poetic in some cases of the way that you can have such an effect, because, you know, I've been raised in the, if it's not this thick, right, and I'm showing 6 inches worth of, of compliance, then it's not worth it. And ultimately, we're saying that that's wrong thinking, and you're proving it every day. Wonderful. Over to you, Tony.
Please.
And Tara, one of the barriers, right, has been that I put blame on folks like us, not necessarily just us, but, you know, the creation of all these independent security frameworks, requirements, recommendation lists, and all this kinds of stuff. And so we're responsible for one of them. And, we're very conscious of this problem that you've taken on, right, which is this multiple framework problem that everyone is just helpless against here. And we have tried to write our guidance in a way that facilitates the sort of things that you're doing. But do you have any other advice or pleas to folks like us? What could we do better on the front end of this, right? Folks who sort of figure out things like best practice lists or recommendations or catalogs or whatever to streamline this, right? You've had to solve a lot of problems, but our goal has been, you know, we want to make it easier right up front. And we think that the way that we write things can have a tremendous impact on the work required to demonstrate, for example, compliance. That if we think about it more carefully up front, we can get rid of a lot of repeat work. Any thoughts along those lines, though? Any advice or things that you'd like us to do?
Well, you're facing a tough challenge because you have a responsibility to try to cover all of the required ground for everybody, right? So that's the reason I've never criticized any of these frameworks for being either too technical and too, no, I take that back. I did criticize CISA's CPGs and I did it a little loudly. And they're based on NIST, but there's a reason for that, right? You never claim, the Center for Internet Security never claims that you should wholesale take, 8 or 8.1 and all of the, on all the controls and all the benchmarks and apply it to a 5-person espresso stand in Seattle, right? You never said that. So there are elements where that's getting pushed upstream to them. And so where I think that you've got an opportunity there, as I think when we looked at CISA CPGs, that's the cybersecurity performance goals. I think you folks are familiar with those. They're based on NIST. And it was almost like they were boiled down. But as a result of getting boiled down, they were posed as something that any small business should be able to use. I disagree with that. I don't think those are able to be used with any small business. Well, they are now because we're actually rolling out the CISA CPGs in the same way we've rolled out the rest of this for small businesses to be able to use. But I think that your real opportunity, Tony, is to take the expectations that you have inside CIS and work with the major adopters of CIS and the major advocates of CIS to have that upstream conversation. What do you expect people to do in order to be a vendor to the organizations that do have to be all the way compliant with 8.1, that have to have benchmarks that you're expecting near perfect compliance from, with few to no compensating controls? So, and the answer is there's got to be a simplified version of that. Now, we've built that, and I know that there's some movement coming to simplify some of the questions that are out there. But have you thought about doing Global Cyber Alliance right now has the Small Business Toolkit, which is the closest thing I've seen to that upstream version of it. Have you thought about maybe taking that toolkit and saying, hey, if you don't know where to get started with CIS and you want to walk into it, maybe stick that a little upstream, right? That's an opportunity there. Or at least have a conversation about the reasonability of the expectations. Because, we rolled out CMMC version 2 level 1, I think about 2.5 months ago. And that's because anybody supplying the Defense Department in the United States as of May of this year is required to be compliant with CMMC version 2 level 1, sometimes even further levels, right? So we rolled that out and everyone woke up and was like, I'm 92% compliant with CMMC. I got chocolate in the mail for that one. It was great. One of our clients was like, oh, Lord. Upon occasion, get one of our clients, and they text me in the middle of the night. They're like, oh, God, I have to have a NIST report by next Thursday. And I was like, chill. It's literally a button you're going to push, and it's going to generate a PDF report for you. And he was moved. Like moved. And in the same way that somebody else I know is thinking about how the people that need to use controls like this are ignored, and we're finally showing them that we're hearing them and we're seeing them. We see you. We see the fight that small businesses are having every single day. And we see the fact that the Small Business Administration in the United States of America has $6 million allocated this fiscal year to support small business cybersecurity. That is not $6 million per state. That is $6 million for the country. Now, there's about 33.6 million small businesses in the country, which means that I could not use the 18 cents allocated to my business to get whipped cream on my latte this morning. So we see the problems. So see them. And when you put together your next TAC, your next advisory council, your next version, put somebody on that committee who's an accountant. I beg you, an accountant of like a 5 to 30 person accounting firm, a legacy accounting firm, more than that. Put somebody who's a normal human being who's going to upstream run into your requirements and ask them what they think they could do.
Okay. We hear you. We hear you. But
absolutely.
You know, as I said, the point is all these frameworks, wherever they come from, they're all well intended. Mm-hmm. Right? But, yeah. You know, we treat them like stone, you know, this is all carved in stone tablets and they're magic or something like that. And the point is help people get moving, get to work, get to move in the right direction, make improvements, but be able to speak to, right, to measure, to demonstrate that you've met, you know, that you're on the road. There is no endpoint, right? There's no sort of magical state that we're going to get to, but, you know, to know that you're in the 80-90% range of the good intentions of any one of these frameworks is like, that's amazing. It's like your point with the passwords, right? You know, this, nobody wants to be the lonely antelope at the edge of the cyber herd. We want everyone moving.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. And it's,
I call him the slowest gazelle at the watering hole.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And that's exactly what it is. And it's not perfect. Yeah. Can never get perfect.
And the flip that's side the is, right, the big, you know, sort of owners, say DOD, US government. The point is we want a very large supply chain for them. We want a rich assortment of vendors competing on price and features. The goal is not pass-fail tests. The goal is to get everyone to improve in a known structured way so we can compare, so we can find trouble spots and invest in there and that kind of thing. So all that, you know, all that. And, you know, you're one of the few I've spoken to over the decades who've tried to look at this at the systemic level, right, really to see this in this sort of broad way, that the point is, you know, we need large scale, right? And what happens, last riff for me, Dara. So I have to ask you this question here. One of the problems when you try to streamline things like compliance, you inevitably run into what I call a government anointed monopoly of assessors, accreditors, testers, auditors, overseers, you know, requirements writers. And any change is a threat to a really lucrative business model. And what you get, though, the feedback, right, is they don't say, oh, you're messing with my business model. They say, no, you don't care about security like we do. Right? They equate the process with better security when, in fact, I think history tells us that's not actually true. But that's the pushback that you get. So you must have bumped into some of these enforcers, caretakers, tea leaf readers, interpreters in your time. So how did you deal with this?
Money. the best answer I've ever had is that when posed with the fact that if they would like to continue guarding their turf in that way, they will not have the most efficient competition for the goods and services they're trying to internally procure, has usually been something that works. Look, people operate according to their incentives, right? And small, just in the same way that a small business is not going to buy security unless they have to. And they often need to be kind of, they often need to hear from their trusted advisors, MSPs, MSSPs, look, if you don't do a little bit of security right now, you're going to be doing very expensive security quickly later if you want to stay in a supply chain, right? At the opposite side of that, the people that are saying, look, you've got to translate all of this, you have to do all of these requirements. Right now, I think, what are there about 512 total companies that are at FedRAMP's highest level of trust? Right. That's all of them. And, you know, we think about FedRAMP as being something that's just, it's right there. Everybody's supposed to be starting to think about that one day. Nobody can do it. Right. The amount of money it costs to get all the way FedRAMP compliant, like high, is so extraordinary that it is a fundamentally anti-competitive measure. And so at that level, I can't have that fight. That's other people's fights. But I can point out the inconsistency and say, you're never going to get the financial outcome you want if you keep pushing regulatory barriers in this fashion. And then I let somebody else argue about it.
Hmm.
No, I hear you. And I think that you're right. I when I've talked, I've spent lots of time talking to auditing communities and folks like that. Here's my answer. If you're any good, there's always great work to be done. We need human beings, right? We need, you know, people who can understand the exceptions and the special cases and the context of risk in it for a particular enterprise. But so much of our industry is kind of grunt work and translation and movement of data and reformatting and, you know, turning this to that. So I think there is a tremendous barrier. So we appreciate all the groundbreaking work that you guys have done to, you know, again, to focus on this, streamlining problem, right? That you used a verb also early in the conversation today, which we love. I would say the verb that matters in cybersecurity is not share. I used to call it the talk that will get you fired in the DC Beltway area. sharing is overrated. Translate is the verb that matters, right? The ability for, you know, your teams to think about how do I translate all this complicated thousands of pages of documents and so forth into something that is actionable, that is a tool that will, you know, implement the intent of it, provide the customer with what they need to survive, right, to deal with the regulatory, the compliance issues and so forth and move on. And so, you know, we're drowning in things, as Sean often references this idea of the fog of war, right? It's not the lack of good resources in computer security, it's the surplus of them that's killing us. And these poor businesses you're talking about have no opportunity to make sense of this. They have to outsource that part of the problem to someone else, to like you, to the MSP, et cetera.
And going to that continuously available or continuously accessible and attestable element we were talking about before, keeping these businesses up to date with that slow drip. Just do 3 push-ups this week. That's all you got to do, and then I'll stop bugging you, right? If you've got that continuous attestation process happening, we describe what happens with our product as the most gentle, long-term, unnoticeable audit you'll ever experience. You won't even notice it's happening. But see, what happens with continuous attestation is there's a flip side to that, which is that your attestation status is continuously available. There's no more one-offs anymore. And that is the thing that angers and frustrates small businesses. They say, I answered this question. And I already answered this question about asset inventory. I already answered all of these questions. Why do I have to answer them again? And the answer is they shouldn't have to. And their answers should be something that are continuously available, just like they should be able to go into QuickBooks and print off their P&L anytime they want to answer questions about how they're doing. And their P&L is continuously available to them. We think that that is only right for small businesses to be able to do the same when it comes to their security and compliance stance.
Brilliant. Wonderful. Well, Tara, thank you so much. Again, enlightening, enriching, motivating. You're doing all the right things and doing it with style as well. It's fantastic.
Well, we didn't get the cocktail waitress career story, but we'll save that for another episode, right, Sean?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tony, we're saving it for the bar.
Sounds
wonderful.
All righty.
Wonderful. Well, a great episode. Thank you so much. Again, thank you, Tony. And thank you to our audience. Remember to subscribe in all the usual ways. Questions, comments, concerns, podcast@cisecurity.org. Make sure to tune in every Wednesday for new episodes. And with that, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the show today. The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS. If you're interested in learning more about how to grow your cybersecurity program, the free tools available to help you on your journey, or to get involved with the CIS volunteer community, visit our website, cisecurity.org. Start secure and stay secure.